Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. This is the SHWEP, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. And today we're speaking with Daniel Harms, Associate Librarian at the State University of New York at Cortland, and a man who knows a thing or two about fairy magic, manuscripts, people, practices, fairies, all that stuff. Dan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
We were chatting earlier, and the thought was that it would be really cool, following the interview we did with Samuel Gillis Hogan, where he kind of introduced this genre of fairy magic manuscripts in the early modern period, to try to put more flesh on the bones in the sense of who are the people behind the fairy magic. So in terms of who's making the manuscripts, who's using the manuscripts, what the audience is for these manuscripts, how dangerous are these manuscripts socially? You know, like how okay is it to even own this stuff? So that's what we're going to talk about today. But before we do that, let me ask you, in terms of the term fairy magic, how useful or kind of accurate or how comfortable are you with that term?
I'm somewhat comfortable with it, which is, I think, the as best we can get there. Fairy magic covers, at least when I've written about it, I had an article or book chapter several years ago on this topic. The difficulty is that you will have experiments that are vastly the same, but may themselves refer to different entities. So if you've got one experiment, may refer to the entity summoned as a fairy, and another one may refer to that entity as the spirit. So the question is, okay, so how do we flesh that out? You've got odd situations where Oberion is sometimes a spirit and sometimes a fairy, and then one manuscript is an angel. So there's some questions that can be raised by this. I do think it's a useful category because I think that within the fairy magic, and there is sort of a continuity with regard to how we might compare this to what we might call demonic magic, mm-hmm. which also itself may be have the same problems. But fairy magic tends to be on a continuity which is very close to that. Or on the other end of it, you could have a ceremony like what I've called the Magrano ritual, where you find an elder tree and you strew consecrated rushes under it. You see a shining herb, and then the fairy lady shows up and does what you want her to do. It's very different from demonic magic. So I think that it has its uses so long as we don't take it too seriously. I think that's generally, not to get too worked up about what the terminology is a useful way to proceed, and being willing to say, okay, well, this is taking a new twist and turn on it.
Yeah. Agreed. Cool. I mean, that's cool just for both to head off at the pass anyone who wants to bring up the whole, like, well, what do you mean by magic anyway? Like, debate, you know, that we've had that debate. It's there. Yes. It's there in the podcast. It's been discussed. But now we want to actually talk about this material. And when we say fairy magic, you're going to have a pretty decent intuitive idea about what we're talking about. There's a distinct family resemblance between a bunch of these practices. So that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
Brilliant. Moving on from there. So am I right to think that we don't really have fairy magic qua fairy magic until roughly the period known as early modernity? In other words, we don't have like medieval fairy magic. Is that right?
It's tough to say because we do have, I think, earlier indications, which I'd have to go back and look at, you know, how far back the manuscripts go. We do have mentions of beings such as Oberion and Sibylla in some of the medieval materials. I think Oberion turns up in the 15th century in some, in like a case of a gentleman who was found using that sort of magic. And there's a mention of a Book of the Sibyl of Sibylla in, I think it's the York catalog of the Friars of York, but at the same time, that, you know, we don't have that manuscript. Also, you know, the Sibyl can mean different things at different times.
It certainly can, yeah.
And so there might be some indications that it was there, but it's very hard to tell. But I mean, when you start to really find things that I would consider like fairy magic, that's usually probably about 1550 or thereabouts.
Okay, so that's our period, and a question probably that we can't answer, though I'd like to, I'm just going to ask it to the ambient, to the room, and maybe you do have some thoughts about this, but, you know, why do we then see an interest in this kind of magic in the early modern period? What's changed? What has caused people to be interested in this? But I'm just throwing that out there. It's an interesting thing to speculate on, maybe unanswerable.
It is, yes.
But one of the things we were going to talk about is the popularity of this sort of material, and then its fall from grace, the fact that people stop being interested in it, stop doing it. What can you tell us about that? I mean, even if we can't talk about causation necessarily, we could at least document that at a certain point this becomes really popular, at a certain point it stops being really popular. So how does that arc look?
Well, I think that when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, that sort of opened up the gates on a lot of magical material in England. So you suddenly had a good number of people who had formerly been, say, employed in some context, now who were being sort of cast out upon the world. We had large libraries that had been kept at the monasteries, which were now also being released. So we start to see what has been called the democratization of this magic. It often travels in sort of informal networks. It's hard to really gauge this because a lot of people who write these manuscripts don't want to put their names on it, or they put their names on it in code. And then, like the Book of Oberon, which is Folger VB26, has as its one of its authors, it has at one point notes that it's by John Porter, but it's written in a code. But one of the things about these codes is they don't really try very hard with the code. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, substitution of letters or even just vowels with numbers, and you just work it through.
Yeah.
But who's John Porter? We don't know. But it does seem that it kind of comes into these informal networks of people who are passing around manuscript material, which was still very much something that was very prevalent in the early modern era for various reasons. You could, even outside of magic, sometimes you had material that was politically sensitive or, that was pornographic that you just, you didn't want to have that printed. So it was easier to circulate that way. Also, you could have material that you wanted to extract from another source and you didn't want to pay for the book. So Maybe you just want to copy down a few pages. And so people are just handing manuscripts back and forth at this time. And that's not just that's manuscripts in a lot of different topics. So you just end up with these learned networks of people who are, they're copying things down and sharing them with each other, and they kind of go back and forth. And as they do so, some of the material that was previously in Latin starts to become translated into English. You do also have a few sort of watershed publications, one of which was Reginald Scott's 1584 Discovery of Witchcraft, which is generally considered to be one of the first anti-witch trial documents in England. And he very much also went down the road of talking about various types of magics and giving examples because he thought that was going to discredit it. And of course, people did what they always do when that happens. They're like, hey, it's a book of spells. Thanks.
Yeah.
So that was one major milestone. Another one, what came about at about the time of the interregnum, press censorship was heavy for political material, but if there was less censorship of magical material. So we do see a good number of publications about around 1660 or so. And so that was another way in which it was traveling. But there's just a number of different ways that this material could travel around and reach different practitioners and reach a much broader audience than it had before.
Okay, so that gives us a picture at least of some important nodes in the story of fairy magic in England, not so relevant maybe to other parts of Europe where we have fairy magic, but or things that we could probably rightly consider part of the same family of practices, but that's okay. Now, what might surprise people who have not studied West European learned magic at all in the Middle Ages and later is that you mentioned these books were in monastic contexts. And that might strike people as a bit funny. Like, monks are meant to be these really, really pious Christian. So, of course, they're not going to be mixed up in anything like demonic magic. Obviously, you know, when we find demonic magic manuscripts from the Middle Ages, they're not coming from a monastic context or a clerical context. They're going to be coming from some kind of magician, Satanists, private individuals, right? Wrong. Maybe you could just you could just talk about that a little bit briefly as a piece of context.
I think to remember is that there are all sorts of different, you know, personalities among these religious specialists.
Yeah.
That many of them, many people, speaking from the medieval context, which I'm not entirely familiar with, but a good number of people who were in training for the priesthood and had some sort of level of knowledge and spiritual authority, right, and rituals and, you know, the sacraments of the church. At the same time, the demand for particular paid positions was high. And so you had a good number of people who were just circulating around who basically had to find some other way to make a living, and some of that could have been magic. Of course, that doesn't mean that some of the people who were priests were themselves not practicing magic. It was, you know, it could be a lucrative sideline or a lucrative job for somebody who was, you know, kind of trying to make ends meet at the time. I'm sure there were some people, a good number of people in those professions who basically said, we're not going to have anything to do with this. But it was also a question of how one defined magic.
Yeah.
And also whether they were going to get caught. In maybe one monastery, it's very, you know, they're very strict. In another monastery, it's just like, okay, well, you know, you came in with some money, maybe we don't really care what exactly it is you do here. That gave the opportunity for monks to build like these magical libraries for themselves. Trithemius is probably the most famous example.
Yeah, case in point, you get a monastery where the abbot is into magic. Who knows what's going on in there, right? Like the doors closed, no one from outside sees what's happening inside. And the abbot is the, you know, if someone wants to get a report on infamous goings on in the monastery that they've heard tell of, they go to the abbot and say, abbot, is anything going on? And he just says, no, God, no, we're just Orthodox as hell. And we're just doing our Christianity all day long. They say, okay, great. Well, problem solved then.
Also, speaking as a librarian, the cataloging of these monastic libraries has left much to be desired. So it wasn't these case where you necessarily, like today we just see, you know, books. Like I've got books behind me. You can see like the names of the books on the spines.
Yeah.
It's very neat. And not necessarily in a monastic library. Sometimes the catalog would be incomplete. Sometimes different works would be bound together. And so it became, you know, you really might not be able to find a magical book in a monastery library unless you got access and then started going through the books a little bit at a time. And that's, you know, we will even get the, you know, charms in the corners or brief operations here or there scattered around. You could probably hide something in there or, you know, just maybe even have it in the open and very few people outside the monastery would know about it or have access to it.
I mean, quite the opposite. Like, how would they find it if they wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's our medieval picture of the kind of fountainhead of a lot of these texts in Western Europe coming out of scriptoria and occasionally the collection of people like bishops, people like that, priests who have a bit of money can afford to have texts copied for them or copy them themselves, but they're not in a monastic context. They're in a city or whatever. Now we're in the early modern period again with our fairy magic, and it's a different context. It's no longer, there's been a, if West European magical texts sort of incubated in the monastic context, they've now, the infection has spread out into society at large, let's say.
Yeah, but how, I would also toss this in, which is something I'm not entirely knowledgeable about this aspect, but I think that the prevalence of paper also made a major difference because it was, you know, it's cheaper, it's easier to get the parchment, and so that makes it easier for people to basically, you know, copy texts and you know, circulate them.
Yeah, people often talk about the printing revolution as a technological revolution, which is not exactly wrong, but paper, that's the technological revolution that changes everything. And that's why you have, for example, such vast amounts of literacy and hundreds of thousands of known titles in circulation in the Middle Ages in the Islamicate world, while in Western Europe, where they're stuck on parchment, it's you can count very easily. You know, we're talking about hundreds of titles rather than hundreds of thousands. In some cases, thousands, but not that many. It's just to do with, like, do you have to slaughter 8 animals to make a small pamphlet, or can you just make a bunch of paper? It's a very simple, like, economic, technological question.
And anecdotally, I can say that most of the material I've looked at has been on paper.
Has been on paper. Okay, that's a really, really important bit of data. That's cool to know. So we see the popularity of this stuff start to spread from the 16th century on. When does it fall off? And do we know the whole story of that, of its falling out of popularity, falling out of use, ending up in libraries where no one looked at it for a couple hundred years until someone dusted it off and got interested in magic and went searching for it?
Well, we should probably put an asterisk by that, mm-hmm. and say that is elite use or elite practice of this magic. Well, that was not to say that that didn't happen still, but I mean sort of the intellectual underpinnings that allowed people who were the cultural elites to continue to practice it kind of fell off. And we don't really know quite what the reason is. I mean, the 17th century, I think Frank Classen has pointed out, is one of the times where you get the most magical manuscripts in England. It's just, you know, this incredible flowering. And then at the end of the century, there's a number of things that could factor into this, one of which is, you know, the rise of skepticism through Thomas Hobbes and other thinkers of that nature, though it doesn't really show up in literature much. And that's mm-hmm. one of the troubling parts, that you get a lot of people who seem to be responding to this sort of sentiment, but you don't really have a lot of publications of that sentiment aside from Hobbes. So by the end of the century, you start to see very different attitudes toward the supernatural. I think a good example that I've used is starting in probably, when did he publish that? I think 1603. King James VI of Scotland, first of England, mm-hmm. publishes his own treatise on magic. And there's one point where he starts talking about fairies. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be good. And he's like, yeah, well, we've got all these legends of fairies. He's got like this dialogue going back and forth between these two fictional characters, and they're like, yeah, we want to, what do we know about fairies? And one of them says, no, we're not talking about fairies anymore. That's just going to get us that's just going to be bad. Just stop it. Whereas at the end of the century, you start to see these books of marvels and wonders where people are like, hey, you know what? There's all sorts of things in creation that we don't know about. There's fairies, there's ghosts, you know, all these things happen to be true. So there's a very intense effort to kind of combat a skeptical, and I don't know if I'd call it scientific, because it's not that refined in terms of scientific itself in terms of its response. It's not about people doing experiments. It's about people having an attitude that these things are ridiculous and silly, and maybe we shouldn't be having witch trials, which is probably true, and all these all these other aspects. And so people start looking at this material very differently. Probably the fact that it is readily available and kind of loses – some of it is readily available and loses sort of that esoteric edge to it where, you know, it's no longer hidden. You could go to the bookstore and buy it, and people could say, okay, well, now I can see what it is. I think that's also a good part of what's going on. But getting into what exactly the dynamic is difficult. That Richard Rowlandson and Hans Sloan in particular, who collected a good number of these manuscripts, which are now at the Bodleian and the British Library, seem to have had the attitude that this was some sort of illness perhaps, or this is a delusion. And basically they were collecting this because they were trying to make a case for that this was, you know, this is something that had gone wrong, and that this was evidence of that. And of course, their collections now are routinely plumbed and published by people who say, hey, thanks for saving the Book of Spells.
Yeah, well, people like you, the other theme as it turns out. It's the old, like, Irenaeus of Lyon problem of, you know, in exposing all the Gnostic heresies, he gave us the best compendium of cool, otherwise lost Gnostic sects of antiquity that we, you know, are constantly, like, so grateful to him for having preserved.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we don't have an answer to the question why fairy magic fell out of popularity, but those are some, I think, valid pieces of the puzzle, right? I think any historian would agree that you're onto something with all these points. The rise in a kind of skeptical approach to the spirit world, generally, always in dialogue with Christianity, where you have to kind of believe in angels, and in dialogue with lots of other things, and the new science, etc. It's never just simple, like, it's all nonsense, unless you're a Thomas Hobbes, who's clearly an outlier.
I would also just remind people that it was at about this time, that all this interest is supposed to be dying off, that we actually get The Secret Commonwealth of Robert Kirk. Mm. And so you've got someone who is basically now – who writes the treatise that everybody refers to now about early modern fairy belief, which I would say is his perspective and not necessarily everyone's perspective. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, there's like this incredible sort of flowering of literature, whether that's print or manuscript, and then just kind of people just decide that that's, you know, not something that they're particularly interested in anymore.
Yeah.
Though it still circulates among, still people who are copying these manuscripts. There are still people who are practicing these manuscripts, usually, you know, the cunning folk and people like that, right, who are, you know, kind of performing different magical tasks for people in their particular area. Mm. But I think we get some Key of Solomon manuscripts, but that's probably about it. We don't see all this wonderful, messy miscellanies that I love so much in the 18th century and on.
Yeah. Weirdly analogously, but I don't mean to imply a causation analogy here or anything like that, but the golden age of Western European alchemical manuscripts, not printed works, but manuscripts, is the 18th century, which is about 100 years, you know, right there in the Age of Reason, about 100 years after Boyle and co. had come up with this bifurcation where you had alchemy on the one hand and this new thing called chemistry on the other hand. And chemistry's winning, and alchemy from, if you're looking at the history of ideas from a bird's eye view, you might say, okay, well, alchemy is kind of dead in the water at this stage, and everyone knows it. But actually, no, this is when there's this huge flurry of activity copying alchemical manuscripts, not just, you know, because anyone can print a book, not anyone, but printing a book is one thing, but putting in the effort to copy manuscripts, especially lavishly illustrated manuscripts, which early modern alchemical works almost always are, is a huge expense, a huge investment of time, and so on. So clearly there's something going on there in the history of ideas that doesn't match the grand narrative we've told ourselves about enlightenment and so on, and the rise of the new science. Okay.
Definitely.
Now, let us turn to the beautiful question of secrecy, or let us say published esotericism. Now, if you are writing a manuscript in a 13th century monastery, it's very easy to see how you would keep that secret and keep it out of the hands. Say it's a bit illegitimate what you're doing. Let's say you're writing a full-on demonic magic grimoire, which is invoking the dark powers of Satan, messing with dead people, you name it, doing all manner of weird sex stuff that's illegal. It doesn't matter, because you know that only you and brother so-and-so are going to see this thing. And you can trust brother so-and-so. And the book, when you're not using it, goes under the loose board in the floor of the scriptorium, and no one will find it there. Okay, that's one situation. Now we're in a different world where books are circulating a lot more than they had been, generally. But also, people are writing with that in mind, right? That's the point. So I guess my question would be double. One is, to what degree does it seem like the authors and owners of these manuscripts need to be circumspect, and you know, what signs do we have of a kind of actual culture of secrecy around these things? And another would be, what kinds of rhetorics are used in the manuscripts to frame this as esoteric knowledge, as knowledge for the few, as the secret knowledge, right? So the genuine concerns of secrecy in the early modern period to do with fairy magic, to what degree is it going to get you in trouble? And then the more sort of the rhetorical side, the side of public esotericism, where you're sort of, for example, putting your name, the name in code, even though the code can be broken in 5 minutes, like what is that doing? It's clearly not just to keep the name secret. It's more of like a kind of a flourish of the esoteric, or at least one could interpret it that way.
I think there were a number of ways to pursue that people could pursue to keep their text esoteric. Though I should also point out that you could also see the opposite. And that's something that comes out of there. You see signs of it, especially later on, especially with the cunning folk, where, oh, you've got to make sure you've got your fourth book of Agrippa on the shelf and very visible, and discovery witchcraft is there. And maybe you leave it open on the table and there's an illustration there. You even see this in the manuscript era. Folger VB26 has some wonderful illustrations of some, you know, demons and things like that. And when I first saw it, I was very excited. I was like, okay, well, you know, oh gosh, this person, I don't know, was on some hallucinogens and they, you know, drew demons in the book. Isn't that so cool? And then I found out later that they copied it out of other books, which were not actually, these were, Satan is in the Folger VB26, is a wild man in a printed work. So that was less exciting. But at the same time, that was clearly intended for people to see that. In fact, there's actually a story about a magician who basically showed a woman a picture of Satan. I wonder sometimes if that was VB26. Here's a picture of Satan. You should sleep with me because I have this manuscript that shows you that I can get in touch with the dark powers. And then she had him thrown in jail.
Bummer.
So there was an aspect to which there was display going on as well. But let's take a step back and look at this from sort of a legal perspective. One of the interesting things, I'm not going to go into the particulars of like Elizabeth's, let's see, it's 1563 law, or King James's, I think it's 1603 to 1604 laws on witchcraft. But the important things about those were, one, they didn't actually outlaw the circulation of literature. They outlawed the practices that were generally seen as, you know, causing supernatural harm, or, you know, in case of James, like, you know, digging up bodies and things like that. It wasn't necessarily for actually possessing manuscripts of magic. As long as you weren't, there was no sign you were doing them, it was also okay mainly to have books of magic kind of lying around. It would be frowned upon. Maybe somebody would, a good number of people would think it was better off if you burned those manuscripts. But, it wasn't itself illegal. So to keep these secret, one, it's just, you know, we're not talking about an era where there's, you know, bound books with, you know, names on the spines. Once again, you know, you could just have a manuscript lying around, maybe bound in with something else. One cool example is actually, it's very late 17th century, and that is Dow's 116, which I published as the Book of Four Occult Philosophers, where you've got most of it's a magical manuscript, but then you flip it upside down, and it's got a bunch of sort of herbal remedies for different things, and, you know, ways to catch fish by poisoning all the fish, which seems like to be like a bad idea if you want to eat the fish later. But yeah, you could just flip the manuscript, maybe put that on the shelf, and then people pull it down. It's like, oh, how to poison fish. This is great. And then they leave it alone, though I don't know if that quite works, because I think they've also got like a title page with Agrippa's face on it on that upside down part. But, you know, there are ways you can do that. Another one key aspect of this material is that it is very special, I'd say, within it to get something like we see come out of John Dee or Humphrey Gilbert, which is people writing about their own experiments. Mm. So you don't really see a lot of that. People were more likely to just copy, you know, the experiments themselves, put it in a manuscript. often without any sort of name attached. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but a lot of these are, you know, we don't really know who wrote them aside from, you know, trying to compare handwriting and things of that sort. So within that context, you know, they could very much sort of circumvent what their actual practice was or where these manuscripts came from, and they could continue to practice. The other aspect we'll see, very simple ciphers. Elizabethan cryptography had, you know, it was pretty advanced at that time. So just changing around some of the letters in a particular operation and keywords of the operation and making those vowels is not going to be that effective if someone really wants to get in there. But if someone's just if you've got this out and you're just showing it to somebody, they're not going to be able to pick up the essence of that particular ritual if you show them those pages.
Right.
So that would be it's a little bit of a technique to keep the material secret, yet without just on a casual glance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like putting a really crap bike lock on your bike. It won't stop a real bike thief, but it'll stop just some dude picking up your bike and walking off with it.
Yes, absolutely.
Like the super casual thief is set aside. If someone's really serious, of course, they can break the code. You know, in a lot of, and this is anecdotal insofar as I don't have numbers here. I can't give you an actual manuscript, but I do know that this does happen in cipher manuscripts of magic in the Islamicate world in the Middle Ages. It's very common to have bits written in cipher, and the book contains the key to the cipher explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not secret. It's just you can't read the page until you've done the work of mastering the cipher and then going back to it. So it's like this sort of, yeah.
Yes.
Like having just a very weak lock on there, but it's still a lock, mm-hmm. sort of. I wonder to what degree as well, just having a manuscript in cipher for that kind of display purposes also gives you a bit of cachet, a bit of social capital of like, you don't think I have a book of magic, or you don't think I can do magic? Well, look at this. Like, you can't even read this, mate. It's written in like a magical alphabet with little mm-hmm. circles on the ends of sticks and stuff. I'm serious.
I mean, none of this was going to really, if the authorities got into your collection and started sniffing around,
yeah.
It's not like these books don't have these large magical circles and things in there, which you could look at and say, okay, I see what you're doing here. But yeah, there was a little bit of precaution taken, and a little bit of plausible deniability built in here and there. And especially, I think the main element is, I think a lot of people really anticipate that these are going to be, they think about John Dee, which is kind of like that's my personal pet peeve, which is everyone interpreting early modern magic through the lens of John Dee. And because John Dee, you know, he had the ear of the queen, and he could write down, you know, all these, you know, spiritual revelations that he was getting, which were definitely orthodox and nothing was wrong with them. Whereas a lot of other magicians would have just said, you know, we can't keep track of what it actually we're doing.
Right.
We're just going to note every so often. One example actually from Dao's 116 is that there were a couple of things that I did to be able to try to figure out who was responsible for it. And the bulk of the manuscript is from 1697 or thereabouts. And one of the only clues that I could find to figure out where the manuscript is coming from, aside from, you know, trying to figure out watermarks and things of that sort, was to find a treasure hunting incantation which actually put the name of a place in there. And I was like, okay, so there's only like four places like that potentially in the UK. And so you narrow it down. And that's about as close as I was able to come. I know they're like, they live somewhere near Stolton Heath, which I think is near modern Worcester. So a lot of these were just anonymous by the fact that nobody put anything really personal in them.
Right. To what degree do you feel that there's, you mentioned earlier that these manuscripts often pertain to an elite practitioner base. Books are expensive. Being able to read is growing in the population in the early modern period, but it's still not that widespread in somewhere like England. So there's some elite, manuscripts are just an elite phenomenon to begin with, to some degree, or at least a self-selecting small audience. To what degree do you feel that there's a kind of continuum of practices from these elite manuscript magical texts into the hedge witches and just general folks of the British Isles in this era. Because one thing, you know, we talked about that these manuscripts stop being produced, but fairy belief doesn't stop. Practices aimed at fairies have not stopped, even in modern day Ireland, where the majority of people will say, no, I don't believe in fairies. There's a group within that group of people who say, I don't believe in fairies, who do practices aimed at placating the fairies, keeping the fairies happy, getting the fairies on side. And if you ask them why they do it, they're like, they give different reasons. Like, well, better safe than sorry, or this is what we've always done, things like that. They don't necessarily even have a reason. It's just what they do, you know, based on our evidence, which obviously is going to be far more written than anything else in this period, because that's what survives. How much do you think there was a continuity or a continuum of fairy-oriented ritual practices from that elite reading and writing manuscript-y group to ordinary folks?
Well, we do actually have some other sources of data for that. For example, we have accounts by people like William Lilly, who, once again, I don't know if we'd consider William Lilly an elite, but that's just because the term elite is a little, you know, we're using an approximation here, who talks about his own practice in his autobiography. We also get people like Mary Parrish, who was the cunning woman employed by the MP Goodwin Wharton in order to find treasure unsuccessfully, and then things went seriously off the rails. She had talked about how she had been, you know, using some elite techniques. She'd been able to obtain magical books. She had then lost the magical books. She had also been able to set up a dead person as her familiar, which is actually something that appears in Discovery of Witchcraft. So, you know, this sort of thing was circulating. And I think it was, you know, making its way down as people became, you know, more and more literate from, you know, kind of the rarefied levels into society as a whole.
Do you see a direction of travel in both directions? In other words, is folk practice informing the manuscript material, and then the manuscript material is also perhaps and literate magic tradition more generally informing folk practice in various levels of filtering down into the populace? Is there sort of a feedback loop going on here?
I think there is, but it's sometimes hard to tell, just because we don't know, you know, there's not formal folklorists at this time collecting this material. This is just, you know, the ridiculous stuff from the country that everybody rolls their eyes at. But thinking about, once again, about things like that Magrana ritual I was talking about earlier, that really feels like something that was a folk ritual that was making its way into the manuscripts. And a lot of these manuscripts are also, we often concentrate on, I think, say something like the Key of Solomon is like the touchstone, and where, you know, you've got this big elaborate procedure, and you've, you know, you get all these tools together and you do things at a particular time at a particular date. But a lot of this, what's in the magical literature is, you know, just little operations, which may have connection with broader intellectual currents of the time, but they, you know, it's, that's a ways away. So you just get, you know, well, you want to have a love spell, write these words down on a piece of, you know, paper, and then touch a dog if you want to see if it works. Poor dog. But you see things in there that do not seem to quite correspond with that. And I think the fairy magic is one of them. I actually cite an example in my article, which unfortunately I can't get permission to publish, and neither can Sam, and it's disappointing for both of us, where you've got like a chapel, and you have to run around it on Christmas Eve at midnight, and then the dwarf comes out, and you're like, well, I gotta steal your cap. So you steal the dwarf's cap, and the dwarf's like, give me back my cap. And then you say, no, because you gotta bring the fairies here. And then he goes and gets the fairies, and then you make a deal with the fairies. That does not seem to be something that derives from from the intellectual climate of the time. That's something very different that's going on, but sometimes it's hard to kind of tease that out. I mean, there is a lot of respect for tradition. There's a lot of material that people will copy over. You know, I've gotten that my Daos 116 contains material from the Pikatrix. Is it particularly useful for to get your gazelle brains in England? Probably not. But, you know, there's an intellectual heritage to some of it. But, you know, others, it seems really like, hey, but somebody just wrote down something they heard in the countryside and tried to, you know, kind of just preserve that so in case it was useful.
Well, I feel like, well, two things. One, I would really love to read a monograph or talk to a scholar who's really, really given thought to what is going on when there are magical manuscripts that demand preparations and ingredients and stuff that are just blatantly impossible to get. Like, what are you doing when you write a spell like that? Because there's a lot of that out there. You know, you have...
I'd say there's some of it. It actually does... It can change over time. Like, there's this whole sort of... I've been looking into this whole tradition about the hoopoe and the hoopoe bird and how the hoopoe bird can... which is probably... You don't read about the hoopoe bird's biology. It just gets worse and worse. They're fine birds. They're fine natural beings, but you don't need to know about all the dung predation and the cannibalism and everything like that, and why they keep their nests so dirty. It's just there's a lot going on with the hoopoe birds, and you realize, okay, that's why the hoopoe bird might be considered unclean by some people.
While in the Islamicate tradition, the hoopoe bird is a symbol of the divine and has an insanely important role to play in Sufi metaphysical poetry and stuff, but that's for another podcast. Please continue.
Yes. So what you get when you come to Britain is that they don't have hoopoes.
Yeah.
But one of the things that has happened during the translation of the Bible, a lot of times the word upupa becomes translated as lapwing, which they had in abundance. So it's kind of a there are cases where you have some sort of transition and some attempt to make something that's actually useful. I actually had a talk with Simon Young about this at one point, which is that I don't feel as if you get a lot of you don't get imaginary ingredients much in these. I mean, maybe you'll get somebody saying, well, you're going to get the ring from the fairies, and who knows if you could actually get the ring from the fairies. But in terms of the ingredients that's put it together, you're not going to see like manticore blood or anything like that in there. The idea is that somebody at some point can practice these. And I feel like there's sometimes when that gets changed, and there's sometimes when it's just kind of like a Wile E. Coyote thing where it's just like, okay, we're just going with what the manuscript says, even though it's not going to be incredibly useful and who. You know, we're not going to be able to find a gazelle or a hoop.
Right. Yeah. So this manuscript originally, if you traced it back, the core ideas go back to a place where gazelles abound. But we, in our copying, you know, respect for magical tradition, are not going to change the bit about gazelles. As hard as gazelle is to get where we are, I will just say that a friend of mine is a member of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And he has seen a hoopoe here on Dartmoor. Mm-hmm. So they do occasionally migrate to England temporarily.
They do. Yes.
The other thing I wanted to mention with regard to that, the dwarf and his hat and all that sort of thing, is we could back up and ask a bigger question, which is that the fact that there's fairies at all in learned magical tradition in a specific spot, namely far Western Europe, Northern Europe, shows the influence of Northern European folk belief on the literate magical tradition, because in, say, medieval Christian magic per se, you've got definitely got God, definitely got Satan, definitely got angels and demons. Those are canonical. They definitely exist. That's kind of it, though. And humans, obviously, souls, you know, kind of being pulled one way or the other. So the fact that there's fairies at all shows that there's a kind of ground up influence on the sorts of magic people are doing. And if Sam is right, Sam Gillis Hogan, which I think he definitely is, that a lot of these spells in their kind of structure, the sorts of practices that are involved, you can show affiliation from medieval demonic magic, like these, some of this stuff mm-hmm. goes back to demonic magic. It's just been adapted for fairies. Okay, like where did the fairies come in? Because local people believe in fairies, right? Or maybe that's part, mm-hmm. at least yeah. part of it.
Yeah. Though I should probably state that there is actually a mention of Oberion in an Italian manuscript in Florence. I'm going to forget the exact... I always forget the exact shelf mark for the manuscript.
We'll put it in the notes.
But, okay. So there is an Oberion ritual in there. So the question on some level is what has survived and, you know, is it just a matter of people, some manuscripts not surviving or people not looking in the right place or things like that? So there, I mean, I put a little asterisk by the fact that maybe fairy magic doesn't occur in other places. Or, I mean, it could yeah. be that this is considered something different. But, you know, it is something that intrigues me somewhat.
Right.
And now I've forgotten your question.
Well, that wasn't really a question. I was just trying to think about more about this question of direction of travel. Are we talking about beliefs and practices going from a literate elite down to the peasants? Are we talking about movement in the other direction? Obviously, this sort of thing is hard to document historically, but just the fact that fairies are in this magical tradition at all is surely a sign of some movement from local, just you could say local belief, or you could say the fact that there are fairies around moving into the literate tradition, influencing a literate tradition, parts of which are inherited from a much longer Abrahamic religious tradition that doesn't have fairies in it. And, you know, that's basically it.
And some of it, I mean, one of the things I've been intrigued by, I don't know if I'll actually ever write a book about it. I mean, I've written one article for a popular audience about it, which was kind of about what I call the table ritual. And I think Claude Lecoutu wrote something about the meal of the fairies. You put out food for the fairies, but more in a formal sense, not just like, okay, I put out a bowl of cream. It's like you have a table, you make everything nice, you get expensive stuff. There's often, you know, three individuals who are supposed to sit there. And this shows up in, you know, it shows up in some of the confessional literature from medieval times. When you're telling people, don't do this. Please don't do this. And then later on, it, of course, becomes something where it turns up in the magical manuscripts, like, here's how to do this. Yeah. And there's a certain amount of, like, tension there sometimes. And I'm not saying that there's not material, say, in the Picatrix, which is also about, you know, serving meals to the spirits and things like that. But it seems like there's another sort of current going here. And sometimes it kind of clashes a little bit with the you know, the demonic magic model, where you've got this whole – this is something that turns up in the fourth book of Agrippa, where they're talking about how to perform this. But they're also like, okay, so we don't need to have a circle. But you're also supposed to be sitting at the table with the fairies. And how does that work? Well, you just have part of the table all over the circle.
Yeah.
That should be fine. Don't worry about that. So it's – you know, I think there are instances where we can kind of see that, okay, this seems to be some sort of folk tradition that is basically being brought in. And there are a lot of these examples where you've got, you know, the three fairies showing up, which is very much an aspect of, like, I want to talk about Persephorist, which is the earliest version of Sleeping Beauty, because that doesn't occur because one of the fairies isn't invited. The sleeping curse is put on the main because they set out the table for the three fairies and one of them didn't get a knife.
Mm.
And then that one was offended and that one inflicted the curse. So there's just some interesting material that's kind of moving around. And sometimes it's hard to sort out what, like with Oberon, who's from Huon of Bordeaux. And that seems to be the origin of it. But of course, maybe it is possible that we find something later on which suggests that he's actually, you know, also a folk spirit. But that seems to be the, as Sam points out, that seems to be the origin from this romance of this Oberion character who turns up in, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream and in magical manuscripts.
Yeah. Or, I mean, at least the popularization, right? Who
Yes.
We don't have to assume that Huon of Bordeaux just invented this character. though dumb. I wouldn't assume that he didn't either. There's some idea that writers in the Middle Ages only carried on tradition. Often just made stuff up really creatively. But he could
be referred back to Alberic and other from the
Alberic, the kind of Germanic dwarf who gets up to so much trouble in the cycle immortalized by Wagner. Daniel Harms, what have we not talked about that we should talk about vis-a-vis fairy magic and the people who did it?
I think one thing I wished to revisit was actually some of the reasons why it became less popular.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of it may have to do with the Protestant Reformation in England. The ritual mechanics of it are very much based in the Roman Catholic faith.
Hmm.
And so you assume you're going to have priests, you assume you're going to have, you know, officials, you assume you're going to be able to say various types of masses. Not to say that that cannot occur in an Anglican setting, but – and a lot of that just kind of – as time went on, it became less and less important. So I think that doesn't rule out the fact that – I think it is very interesting that people at a time when people would take their books of hours and and excise – like references to the Pope and things like that. And so one of the key indicators of where a manuscript, a book of hours was in terms of an English audience, whether that was written, kept in England or kept on the continent, is whether they've excised that or not.
Right.
But there's a lot of material in there that's still Roman Catholic. That doesn't mean that some people didn't try to Protestantize it. I think Humphrey Gilbert, Frank Classen, talks about how he went in and, you know, seems to have like cleaned things up and tried to make it good for proper Anglicans. But at the same time, I think that's also part of like that sort of collapse over time of that sort of ritual world was also very much something that kind of took the whole phenomena down with it.
Right.
Because if you're just supposed to call on, you know, God if you want to get something done. You're not supposed to have this weird ritual which you do and a bunch of prayers and then get in touch with an angel who gets in touch with God.
Yeah.
That's not how things are supposed to be done. You just call God, and then if it's not good enough, then that's on you.
Right. I mean, there's another branch of Protestantism, more extreme, like the Calvinists, the radical dissenters of various sorts, the people running amok in England during the interregnum that you mentioned earlier, some of whom were what modern people would call extreme religious fundamentalists of various kinds, for whom you don't even pray to God for stuff to happen. You just really hope you're saved. and actually, any idea that God intervenes is superstition, right? Some of these people, mm-hmm. like the idea that God or his angels are sort of doing anything in the world is superstitious papist nonsense. In other words, these are guys who are not just cutting the Pope's name out of their book of hours. They're like, all prayer, as Christians have understood up till now, is ritual magic and forbidden, because that's kind of what Augustine says about magic. You know, they're this radical critique of everything as superstitious, as papist, other, now forbidden, extends to most of Christianity, in fact, right? Which is another strand in this discourse going forward, I would say.
That opens up more possibilities and opens up more dialogue in terms of like what people have to deal with. And so it pulls society, you know, even if most people were not that extreme, it sort of pulls society in a direction where now we're having a conversation about this. And which means that the magic is looking more and more sort of questionable if it, you know, refers to material that sort of worldview, which is no longer prevalent.
Yeah. There's a really interesting take on demonology, which occurs in this period among Protestants. I'm trying to remember where I read about this. You probably have a better handle on it than I do. But the notion among some Protestants that Of course, demons are real, because as Protestants, it's more important that you believe in the devil than it is that you believe in God. Demons are real, but they cannot actually change anything in the world. So all this magic stuff mm-hmm. is superstition, because demons just physically can't make stuff happen, but they can create illusions. Mm-hmm. So they can affect your mind so that mm-hmm. magic, so the devil is there deceiving you like he's supposed to, and his demons and doing all that stuff. But he doesn't have like miraculous powers to make things actually happen in the world. So it's a kind of weird combination of a skeptical debunking approach to the whole exercise of demonic magic, while still making demons real and making it a major sin to do this kind of magic. But it's just been psychologized, kind of.
Yes, yes. I think that's certainly the case. I mean, because demons are, in these manuscripts, there's quite powerful. They're like, you know, okay, well, we want to destroy a bunch of towers. Yeah, sure, they can do that. Carry people from one place to another. There's one where, you know, bringing souls back from purgatory. Okay, well, we can't have purgatory. That's going to be a problem. Mm. At the same time, though, the late 17th century attitude is also, yeah, this could be illusion, but you should definitely know about it. We definitely want to talk more about this because it's important, and we don't want to have people thinking they should just, you know, become good little atheists. We can't have that. Mm-mm. So all of this stuff is real, and you should definitely believe in it, but it's not powerful, and also just you're going to have to – you should continue to believe in God. Please don't stop.
Okay, Daniel Harms, one more question for you. As someone who's published works coming from what I would describe as a very responsible historicist, philological – approach to this material, but has put a lot of primary source fairy magic out there into the world. What do you think of what you might call elite to folk pipeline, in the sense that you are someone who's educated and can read Latin and so on and so forth? You have a very specific, very narrow skill set, and you're taking manuscripts and making popular editions of them. How many of the people who read your English translations and editions and so forth are reading them to do the magic, would you say, anecdotally? To what degree are you feeding a new wave of fairy magic?
I don't know. People don't write me for some reason to tell me that they're doing magic. I know some people are.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell. Also because, you know, most people just buy books and read them, and you know, they don't necessarily do the ritual. This is like this is just common among occultists. Like, very few rituals actually get done, but people read a lot. Not to say that I'm not trying to bash anybody here. It's just, yeah, we people like buying books on the topic, and, you know, they getting around to doing rituals is another thing. Hmm. I think it's important to get it out there. I've realized that there's one of the deep problems with the study of magic is the lack of accessible texts. I feel like for a lot of the 20th century, understandings of magic came really down to, you know, stuff that Mathers and Crowley did, and just like this very small corpus of texts that they produced, and that was what was supposed to be important. I mean, the fact is we do not have. Even though I say this as I know people are working on it, and I also know that it is a tremendously complex task, but we don't have a critical edition of the Key of Solomon yet. It's,
which is
that's
bonkers.
That's just astounding. Yeah,
it's bonkers.
Yeah, and being able to just give people access to these documents, whether they're practicing them or not, is expanding our knowledge of these. Another thing that I'm running into is that, and I've talked with some of my fellow scholars about this, is we don't have terms for a lot of these, what we're seeing. I've got this weird little, you know, wax figure, right, where you just, you know, you draw, you know, sigils on the wax figure with when somebody steals something from you, and then you put it near the fire but not in the fire, and you call out to Raguel and Uriel and Sabaoth, I think. And it's just, it turns up all the time, but it doesn't have a name. It's like, you can't say, well, this is for theft, because that doesn't describe anything in a magical manuscript. There's so much stuff for theft. But being able to at least say, hey, what people think is a weird one-off thing or one occurrence is actually something that connects to these broader traditions, that people are circulating, that people are talking about them, that they have variants that can then, you know, that we can explore, and that will, maybe that will tell us something. Mm. And I think that's – so putting out as material, I'm generally very good with it. I know that, you know, the quality of magical publications varies. I know that my publications – I work with Joe Peterson on the Book of Oberon. It completely ruined me, Joe, because now I got to come up to his standards now. It's just like, well, none of this stuff I did before is any good. I got to really do it well. But even if it's not great, you know, we can always, you know, it's getting things out to people, and it's, you know, letting people see that what's going on, and then people can take that and maybe, you know, scholars will probably go back to the original manuscripts, but at least having material out there where people can look at and they can think about and they can search, I think, is very important for the continuing of the history of this, of magic, and being able to come to some sort of conclusion and broader understanding of, you know, basically the human condition. We just have all these manuscripts that tell us all about what people's insecurities and wants and desires were, and I think that's just kind of amazing, and it's a shame that we kind of hide it behind shame and very bad cataloging, where we call everything charms and receipts or something like that.
Yeah, or don't mention it at all. Sometimes in the catalog,
it doesn't have a person's name on it. It doesn't have Aristotle's name on it, so we don't know what it is.
Yeah, nice one. Well, Daniel Harms, keep up the good work. Keep fighting the good fight, and until we next see you, or until your next publication, or both. Stay esoteric.
Thank you.